checking out Real Talk Personal Finance. Shit's about to get real. Cashflow King with you today.
Money, baby. You need net worth. You need passive income. You need flows, baby. Flows and flows and flows.
And hopefully my voice sounds a little better versus the last time where it was pretty raspy. We have a repeat guest, our first repeat guest, or the first ever guest that was on the show, to join us for episode number 13, which is called Cashflow Investing versus Growth Investing, featuring Cube Crusher. Please welcome back to the show, Cube Crusher.
Dick, here's the deal. I'm the best there is, plain and simple. I mean, I wake up in the morning, I piss excellence.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here again. First recurring guest of this worldwide podcast.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, I didn't bring this up beforehand. Let's do it right now real quick. We did have one additional, we had a couple additional locations, but one that was, I believe, international. Let me see if I can find this under locations here on my wonderful Buzzsprout dashboard. We have shout out to listeners in Singapore, I believe is new. We haven't had them yet appear on the different countries that are listening to the show, so thanks very much. And it looks like Sharon, Pennsylvania is kicking ass versus Nicholasville, Kentucky, San Diego, California, and Pasco, Washington, but we certainly appreciate all you guys and all the rest of our listeners. And then finally, special shout out to two new cities and states that have popped up on the map recently here. Looks like Columbus, Ohio and Williston, South Carolina are on the board. So thanks so much for your listenership. We hope you like the show. And if you do, please feel free to leave a 5-star review if you feel like we've earned it. We really appreciate it. All right, so we're going to go ahead and we have somewhat of a tentative outline, so to speak, today, but really we're just going to kind of roll with it and have a little fun with this one and talk about different styles of investing and investment philosophies today. And before Cube Crusher and I get into a battle of disagreement on some different things, which hopefully you guys enjoy listening to, we certainly enjoy the almost daily banter over text message back and forth about different investments. But anyway, I think we'll start off with something that we both agree with, and that is with regards to financial foundation. So I'm going to turn it over to Cube Crusher here and just let him kind of set the framework before we get into different types of investments and investment philosophies. What are some things that the listeners should be thinking about doing or have done prior to getting very involved with certain types of investing?
Yeah, like we kind of discussed the last time that I was on, you know, different things such as savings rate. To me, that's the most important part of a financial plan for anybody, because the higher your savings rate is, the more flexibility you're going to have, the more investment choices that you can make with your funds to invest. So really, to me, your savings rate is the important thing, because that'll kind of help take care of your emergency fund, make sure you have a healthy bank account or whatever makes you comfortable, and, you know, minimize credit card debt or have no credit card debt. And then that can really let you, I guess, be a little bit more aggressive as far as exploring different investment options at that point.
So real quick, savings rate, for those of you that may have missed it, or if you're a new listener just joining us, I do an episode, I should say, on savings rate, which is episode number 7, titled What's Your Savings Rate? And then, as Cube Crusher mentioned, we did talk about a lot of different things the last time he was on the show. And here we go, episode...
Whichever one was the most highly rated.
Yeah, probably number 4. Yeah, it is. Episode 4, Retire at 40 with 5 Principles, featuring Cube Crusher. So that is episode number 4. For anybody that missed it, if you want to go back and check those out, feel free to do that. And then, final thing I'll say before I turn it back over to you, on the emergency fund part, we did an episode titled What Level is Your Emergency Fund? And that is episode number 2. Episode 2. All right, please continue.
Yeah, so once you have those kind of things set in place, at that point you're probably going to have some different accounts that I know you've discussed and I discussed briefly when I was on. You'll have retirement accounts, non-retirement accounts, possibly some crypto investments as well. I know that you aren't a fan of those. But,
shitcoin.
You know,
fucking shitcoin. Yeah. Keep going.
There's all kinds of possibilities out there. Once you have the basics in place, you can kind of go out and explore if you want to. Or if you just want to be, you know, lazy about it, or the easiest possible thing, there's always index funds, which I like to call shit tax funds. Because I just don't really, you know, it's good for some people that want to be lazy, but ultimately, you're going to own stuff in there that you don't really want to own within an within a shit dex fund.
All right, before we get into shit dex funds and shitcoin and everything else that starts or ends with shit, let's wrap up the financial foundation. So basically, I think we're in agreement. You want to pay off any type of high interest rate credit cards, or preferably all credit cards, unless you have a very specific action plan with some kind of an introductory 0% promotional rate and you are pretty much 100% confident you're going to pay it off before the rate jumps on you. But all else being equal, you will want to pay off credit cards. You want some sort of quote-unquote emergency fund, depending on how you feel about that. Check out the other episodes for more info. And then the high savings rate / investment rate, and we had a show on that as well. But we're pretty much in agreement on those three big items. Not to say that you can't invest before, you know, having a fully funded emergency fund. Like, for example, if you're getting a retirement plan match at work or something like that, you can certainly take advantage of that. But in general, those three big items, I think we're in agreement that before you get into significant investments of any kind, you want to make sure that you have a solid financial foundation, and those three things are part of that. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. And those aren't the only things. Like, I did a show on life insurance basics, episode 11. So that's not to say you can forget about things like that. If you have a need for life insurance, then you want to make sure you have that in place. If you're not sure, check out episode number 11. Same thing with things like estate planning. I know I beat up Cube Crusher a little bit on the last show for not having estate planning documents, and no, we're not going to put him on the spot and ask him if he's done that today. But that is episode 9, fundamentals of estate planning. So there are some other things, but I'm just talking strictly from a dollars and cents standpoint. You know, what are the big basic bullet points? And so all those things pretty much come into play that, you know, you want to make sure you have as solid of a financial foundation as possible. All right. So that's on financial foundation. Next, the biggest section of the show, and probably where we're going to spend the meat of our time, is on investment philosophy. And I guess I'll start with my overall investment philosophy. We'll then turn it over to Cube Crusher, and he can talk about his investment philosophy. And then we'll probably have some friendly banter back and forth about essentially poking holes in each other's philosophies / strategy. And it's not to say that one is right or wrong, or one is better than the other, although I think my way's better and he thinks his way's better. And that's for you to decide for your own situation what that looks like. But we'll have a little fun with it, and then we'll take it full circle and close out the episode. So that's pretty much what we have on tap today. So I'll start with my investment philosophy, and anybody that knows me has probably heard me say many different times, I like to think that I'm probably the most ambitious, lazy person that you know. And how that formulates my investment philosophy is I want to be as close to 100% passive as possible in anything that I do. And I realize that that's not going to be completely possible with certain types of investments, and we might get into those a little bit later in the show. But the underlying theme is that I want to try as much as possible to do something once and get paid forever, and set things as much as possible on some sort of autopilot so that I can not really have to get my hands dirty, right? I want to send my money, my dollars to work. I want them to come back with friends, and I want to do as little as possible in the process. Now, I know that probably sounds too good to be true. Is it always 100% passive? No. Are there some complicated things and factors and additional costs and expenses that will come into play? Yes. But that is kind of the way that I view the world. And I value, I think we both do, our time very, very much. And whether that time is spent really for leisure purposes or vacations or doing whatever the hell you want, I think we would both say, at least to some degree, the definition of success in some capacity has to do with the freedom of your time and being able to do what you want when you want. And so that is something that I don't want to, I want my investments to work for me. I don't want to have to be getting my hands dirty all that much, if at all possible, and I want it to be as simple as possible, but I do want to invest aggressively from the savings rate standpoint in terms of how many dollars and how much money on a percentage basis is going into different types of investments. And so that's my overall belief, and then I guess I'll comment really briefly, and then I'll turn it over to him, and we'll go back and forth here on how I started and the types of investments that I was doing then versus what I'm doing now and the overlap between the two. And so I think if I look back, probably about 15 years ago at this point is when I first started investing. And so at that time, quite frankly, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And my initial investments were stock market-based investments before I got into this industry. And that was primarily through my 401k, through my employer at the time. And then very shortly after I started investing there, I also discovered, became aware of, and started putting money into a Roth IRA. So those were my initial investments. And for the first, we'll say 10 years or so, pretty much everything that I did was in some way, shape, or form tied to the stock market. And I didn't fully understand at the time what I was doing. I was told, you know, put money away from your very first paycheck. You'll never miss it. You know, I don't come from money. That's part of the reason that I do what I do for a living. And, you know, don't do what we did was pretty much the advice that I got. And so I listened, but I still didn't fully understand, well, why is that important and why does that matter? But I think I'm quote unquote supposed to do this. And so I did. And so for 10 years, those were kind of how my investments were formulated, and they've done fairly well over time. And then for the past 5 years or so, I continue to do a lot of that, and I still do. But I've added, and that's kind of where my quote unquote argument will come into play a little bit later in the show, I've added a different style or element of investing where I've focused not so much on growth investments, although I still do that, and I've kind of front-loaded a lot of those funds. But now I am more focused on, or just as much if not more focused on, cash flow types of investments, which we can get into throughout the show if we have time, where I want dollars that are coming in on a residual passive basis to the extent possible that will allow me to buy back my time. And, you know, if I wanted to retire, quote unquote, early, or take a job doing something else where it's even lower stress and making less money, I could do that because I have residual cash flow from these other types of investments that can, if I desire, be used to fund my day-to-day lifestyle expenses. And so my philosophy has sort of flipped, and I am focusing on putting more and more money into cash flow types of investments. And like I said, I still do growth-oriented investments, but it's really not as big of a focus, although I am still putting away a fair amount into those types of investments. And the last thing I'll say is, essentially by front-loading the money in the beginning, some people will call this, I think, coast-fi. I could essentially go work at McDonald's and just, if I had no cash flow, for example, and no other passive income investments, and just pay my bills and never save another dollar or invest another dollar, and I would be quote-unquote just fine by traditional retirement age. And so that's, you know, one thing that I'm very happy that I was able to do. And anyway, so that's kind of my investment philosophy, what I've done for the past 15 years, broken down into chunk number one, which is the initial 10, and chunk number two, which has been the last five. And I won't go into too much more detail than that at this point. I want to turn it over to Cube Crusher and get his investment philosophy and kind of a, you know, brief timeline on what he's been up to.
Yeah, so my general investment philosophy, there's, I think it's a quote, I don't know who the hell said it at one point or another, is that concentration creates wealth, and then once you're wealthy, diversification maintains your wealth. So I guess I probably started investing about 10 years ago. I believe it was in a Roth IRA similar to you. And I honestly, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, really. I just kind of went in, started buying some stocks because that's where most of my investments are. I started trading options pretty early just to see what the heck that was all about, because that's the type of stuff that people will, you know, see on TV or when they're watching the Wolf of Wall Street or something. They're trading all kinds of crazy derivatives and stuff. So I generally started saving in a Roth IRA account. You know, in the last several years, I've kind of shifted some money over to after-tax accounts, but, all of, our investments that we have, I pretty much have everything that is self-directed. I invest all the money myself, into individual stocks, some ETFs, but not many. Because I like individual stocks based on, you know, companies that are growing typically is what I'm buying. I don't want your old boring, you know, Wells Fargo Bank, even though I did own it at one point until I kind of changed my philosophy on everything. And that's not investment advice to buy or sell Wells Fargo Bank. But, you know, the old companies that have been around that, you know, aren't growing as much. Yeah. Are there reasons that some people own them? Sure. But that's not for me. I don't think that's the best way to grow your assets as much as possible. What I look to is what I guess the lingo, the Wall Street or the CNBC lingo that you see is secular growth companies. And that basically means that no matter what the heck is going on, you know, in the government around the world. No matter what, these companies are designed and they continue to grow, and they can see pretty massive growth. And then obviously, you know, usually the stock return will reflect that type of growth that you're seeing within the company over a period of time. You know, as long as you have the nuts.
These nuts.
To keep holding when things go south, which inevitably they will, because, you know, I guess these are some of the companies that are considered higher risk by people. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that interests me. So I kind of research a little bit, you know, here and there, and then kind of think of what themes, I guess, are taking over, or what type of growth are we seeing? I mean, right now, you know, you think internet, e-commerce, that type of thing. So that's kind of what my philosophy has evolved to, is that, you know, getting most of my money into these growth companies and individual stocks. There are some accounts that we have that, you know, you don't have the option to self-direct it or pick your own. You're basically stuck with a selection of, you know, 10 different index funds that you can put money in. You know, if that's the case, which is the case for a lot of, you know, employer-sponsored 401k plans, 403b, whatever, you know, you're kind of stuck there. But for the most part, I kind of follow the market fairly closely, follow my stocks. But the one thing I guess I would warn against is I'm not trading much at all. I'm buying stocks that I think are the best companies in the world, and I'm either holding them until they go to zero, or until I need the money, or unless, you know, something happens that makes me not think that company is going to continue to grow, or their, you know, obviously their stock performance won't grow with it in the future. That's what I've evolved to. And then here recently, I have begun to get into your favorite thing of crypto. The biggest thing about it to me, as well as the other individual companies and what I'm investing in, is what they call asymmetrical bets. Basically, anything that you buy, unless you get on margin and go crazy, it can only go to zero. You can only lose all the money you put into it. But at the same time, on the other end, what makes it asymmetrical is you could get, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of percent return on your investment by buying and holding. And, you know, if the asset or the stock performs over time, you can really, really see a lot of growth in your portfolio and in, you know, what your net worth is in a pretty quick period of time. But I caution to say that, because as quick as it goes up, it can go down. And I do, you know, everything I buy with the intention to never sell it and hold it. And honestly, if it goes up, I might buy more of it. A lot of people think when stocks go down is when you should buy more. I don't really agree with that general take either, as part of my overall philosophy. But that's I guess kind of where I'm at, is mostly growth companies, individual stocks, and in crypto.
All right, so a few things. First of all, thank you for that. We need to make sure, and I know you said it, but I'm going to say it anyway. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only. We do not give any advice. We give ideas and information only. There is no tax, legal, or financial advice being given on the show. Anything and everything you may decide to invest, you can do so on your own research, your own time, based on what you feel. Please don't take anything that's said on the show by Cashflow King, which is myself, Cube Crusher, or any other guest as advice, because it's not. And if you do something stupid, well, that's your fucking problem. Anyway, all right, so that's the disclaimer. I want to get that out of the way. Second thing I will say, with that said, Cube Crusher has a pretty phenomenal ability, of the people that I know personally, to actually pick stocks. And to my knowledge, he's not come out with a newsletter yet, and he's not given any advice, so this is not really designed for that. But I will say, he can pick them better than most, including myself. I am fucking horrible at choosing individual positions, as I've proven to myself over the years, so I don't even try anymore. I am a big fan of index funds in general, for the growth-oriented investments that he mentioned or alluded to. So I wanted to say that really quick. The other thing is, he mentioned self-directing. There are a lot of folks out there. I just want to clear that up a little bit. when he says self-directing, I guess technically that is correct. Basically, what he's talking about is kind of the do-it-yourself investor or investing, but he's not talking about, there are certain types of quote-unquote self-directed accounts where you can buy non-traditional investments, which are typically things that are not in the stock market. So for example, if you have certain types of self-directed retirement accounts, you can invest in businesses, you can invest in real estate, you can invest in notes and land and all kinds of other different things. Again, not a recommendation to do any of that, just information only. However, there is a difference between a self-directed account and just your sort of typical accounts where there's the do-it-yourself component, which is what he is talking about. So I just wanted to make that distinction. And the last thing, which he mentioned on the asymmetrical risk, I totally get that. And I can see why somebody may want to take a very small percentage of their net worth, which I believe is what Cube Crusher has done and is doing, to make asymmetrical bets. I don't disagree with that at all. However, when it comes to specifically cryptocurrencies, I will be honest and say that I don't fully understand them. I've listened to several podcasts on them. I've had conversations with different people to have them try to explain it to me. And although they can recite a few different bullet points and sound bites and things of that nature, I've never come across anybody that can, in an articulate fashion, fully explain to me exactly what's going on as an investment thesis or basis for making certain types of decisions. So although it could be, and maybe is, a very good quote-unquote asymmetrical bet, it's not something that I personally am comfortable with. As I always jokingly say to Cube Crusher when we kind of have our friendly back and forth, I'm already rich. I don't really care. You might get richer than me someday by doing that, and that's fine, but I'm going to invest in things that I understand and things that I know. And again, you as the listener can make your own decisions about what you may or may not choose to invest in based upon a whole host of factors. We're just kind of having a little fun doing the episode today. So, all right, let's get into, now that we've both sort of given a baseline for investment philosophies and the types of things that we invest in, this is probably a good time to, I guess, cut up a little bit and instead of sort of a monologue for each of us, get into a little bit more of a dialogue on our viewpoints on this as far as, you know, growth investing versus cash flow investing. And I know Cube Crusher's not a big fan of dividends and things like that, and even real estate to that for that matter. So how do you want to start this one? Let's have a little fun here.
Well, you kind of stole my thunder. The hot take of the year on the podcast is coming right now. And that is, dividends are the biggest bullshit in investing. Hands down. It honestly, I don't know why people are so obsessed with them. I think it's a mental thing and it gives them the warm and fuzzies if their stock pays out a 3% dividend, which doesn't mean jack shit when the stock is continually going down anyway. But for some reason, it gives them the warm and fuzzies to know they're getting 3% while they're losing 20% in the stock. Also, dividends should, well, personally, I think they should never be owned in after-tax accounts. Basically, you're just creating a tax bill for yourself. Yes, they may be taxed at a preferential rate, which is all good and well, but there's no difference between that and just selling part of the stock that you hold to create your own dividend.
Well, that, okay, so let me jump in here. So this is the part where we're going to have some fun. All right, so look, let's talk about this. So you just mentioned selling part of the stock that you own, okay? And this goes to, and the reason I had to jump in here is when I think about rental real estate specifically, all right, let's just take a single family home, for example. There's a lot of major benefits, but the major benefit in my mind from an income generation standpoint is you never have to liquidate the asset to generate the income. Now, you could simply hold a stock or a mutual fund or an ETF and have that dividend yield stream coming in. That's fine. But to your point, at some point, you may need to start to liquidate a portion of your position. I'm not going to start selling off square footage in a house to generate the income. I own the house, I rent the house, and we can get into all the metrics if you want to in terms of how you calculate certain things and different reserve amounts and whatever. But at the end of the day, the house produces income. I don't have to sell, right? So what's your response to that?
Right. So the way that I look at it, the companies that I am invested in, obviously they have cash flow. Here are their options of what to do with that cash flow. The first and the shittiest option is pay a dividend to their shareholders. But what that does is, for whatever reason, shareholders love those. And on top of that, it does, you know, get these companies to where these ETFs that are dividend ETFs will, you know, they have to own part of that. So it helps them, I guess, be more widely held by those, which I guess theoretically could help their stock price. Another option that they have with that, with those, is they could buy back stock, which is literally the same exact thing as a dividend, except for you are taxed 0% on it. They could take, you know, whatever the percentage is that they're paying you in a dividend and take that same capital and buy back their own stock, reducing the shares outstanding, and essentially have the same exact impact as a dividend that's coming to you. The third thing, and the thing that I prefer that my companies do, is to take that money and reinvest it in their own company, because those people are smarter than I am. I'm just an idiot that's buying stocks. So why would I want them giving me more money to buy their shares, theoretically, if I'm reinvesting my dividends? Why would I rather do that than have them reinvest it in themselves? Because a lot of these companies have the smartest employees in the world working for them. So why do I want that cash instead of them reusing it and producing a higher return on that cash than what I can if it's given to me?
I don't disagree with that, but it, in my mind, everything comes back to financial flexibility. So you mentioned earlier in the show that, you know, you have some after-tax accounts. I do as well. I think the biggest mistake that a lot of people make, myself included, is they wait or have waited way too long to start to invest money outside of a retirement plan. And what I did probably for most of the first 10 years, I can't remember exactly when I started my first after-tax brokerage account, but I put initially primarily all of my investable dollars into these retirement plans, which there's some exceptions and ways to get money out early, and we're not going to cover that on today's show. But generally speaking, that money is trapped and locked up for an extended period of time, generally speaking, until age 59 and a half, with a few exceptions. And so I think flexibility is the most important thing. And so when I look at it, especially in the context and through the lens of early quote-unquote retirement, I want the most flexibility possible. I want to have cash flow available today. I want to have investments I have access to today, although I do think liquidity is overrated. We can touch on that if you want. But I want the money available. I don't want to put it into something where I either have to liquidate the asset and presumably pay taxes, which is, again, debatable, when I sell to generate the income. I want to be able to just have income streams, as many as possible, dripping in and flowing in. And I know you're going to say, well, that creates taxable income and yada, yada, yada. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, depending on how you do it. And we can get into that if you want. But I want the most flexibility. And in my mind, that does not give me the most flexibility. And the quote that, I don't know who came up with this, I typed this out in preparation for the show, and I might have even said this before, and I'm not taking credit for this. I'm sure other people have said it too. But at the end of the day, not that I needed to, but if I did, cash flow buys groceries and unrealized capital appreciation doesn't, period. If my account goes up in value and I need, you know, I lose a job or something, yeah, you can say, well, that's what your emergency fund's for. Okay, fine. But for an extended period of time, like I can't go down the street to, you know, the grocery store and buy groceries with that unless I liquidate the asset. But if I have cash flow coming in, especially on a monthly basis, even quarterly, that allows me more flexibility. And even if I don't need it for consumption purposes, I can always reinvest it. You can argue there's a little bit of tax drag, but I think that gives you more flexibility overall than strictly growth-oriented investments.
Well, if you didn't want to sell any of your shares and essentially create your own dividend, you always have the option to, you know, take a loan against your account value, and then your account stays the same, and you just have debt that, you know, that is your cash flow that you have.
But it's non-deductible, right? If you're using it for consumption. Now, if you're using it for investment purposes, that's different. But if you have an account and let's say you go on margin, you take a margin loan, and all of a sudden now, I mean, what, are you going to use a margin loan to go buy groceries?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're that damn worried about selling some of your stock, then that's another option that you have.
It is.
I guess the last thing of my dividend rant is that, you know, dividend investing, I guess if you Google it or look it up, you're probably going to find a lot of articles too that refer to value investing. They're kind of synonymous. Well, the greatest value investor, and everybody's heard of him, his name is Warren Buffett, arguably the greatest investor who's ever lived, who he is a value investor. But the company that he owns, Berkshire, he always stated that they would never pay a dividend, because he knows how dumb dividends are. I think once in their history, I don't know, you'd have to look it up, but I believe they did pay a dividend. And he claimed that the reason that it happened was he was in the bathroom when they voted on it or something. So they got it by him and did pay a dividend one time. But, you know, arguably the greatest value investor ever hates dividends. So why would anybody like them?
Because the most famous and wealthy investor of all time, if we're going to say that that's him, and I don't know that to be fact, but I would say that, you know, you could make that argument and that it's probably in the ballpark of being true. If he's not number one, I'm sure he's in the top handful of people. He's not worried about it, right? He probably already has multiple income streams. So why the hell does he give a shit about a dividend? If you're average Joe, right? Joe Sixpack or whatever the fuck the saying was back in the day. Like, if you're just trying to create some financial flexibility in your life and you have an income stream versus not having an income stream, I would make the argument that having it is going to put you in a better overall position. And guess what? If you don't need it, you can always reinvest it, but at least you have it there to make a decision. And I think that any minimal tax impact or quote unquote tax drag that somebody might experience because of that is well worth the peace of mind of knowing that you have money coming in the door every month, whether or not you ever get out of bed. And that's kind of where, you know, that's how I feel about it anyway.
Well, that goes back to my first point of giving people the warm and fuzzies that they don't have to sell their shares when they're down 40% because they're still yielding 3% on their dividend. So everybody's happy.
But what if they're not? Okay, I know there's probably a few companies, maybe more than a few, that has happened or could happen with. But generally speaking, markets go up, values go up, stock prices will go up over long periods of time. So even if there's a temporary 40% decline or setback, first of all, that's an argument of why you may want to diversify investments outside of the stock market, which I'm a big fan of, but also that eventually those things are going to go higher anyway. So if you're temporarily down 40%, it doesn't matter if you're getting your 3% yield. Similarly, on the real estate side of things, if you have, and of course this isn't the case right now with housing prices as crazy as they are, and single family homes, even rentals are valued based on, you know, market comps, comparable sales, the values are all up. But even if those values dropped 40%, but you still have a tenant and they're still renting from you, and even after all expenses and reserves, you're still cash flowing, you still are receiving income and you're not having to sell the asset, just like you wouldn't have to sell your stock market portfolio if it was down by 40%. It just, you're right, it does give people, I would say, the warm and fuzzies. What's wrong with that? I guess that's where I'm still a little bit like, why not?
Oh, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, I guess, but I just think that it's highly overrated. I mean, they'd be better off just, I mean, why would you rather have a dividend as opposed to them buying back their own shares, which basically, I guess, for lack of a better term, it artificially inflates their stock price or puts a floor on their stock price, you know, because if it hits a certain point, then they're going to be in there buying shares. The company will be themselves. And there's no, you know, zero tax implication to that for the investor.
I think that's fine. And I think everybody, you know, I guess will make their own decision. Let's say, okay, so you give me shit all the time about how I like to. I am one of those people that doesn't think dividends are bullshit. I think they're fantastic. But I think that real estate investments, generally speaking, from an income play standpoint, is way better. And so, but even with my, let's say my brokerage account, my taxable brokerage account, for example, I have a portfolio of ETFs, exchange traded funds, and, you know, they're pretty well diversified, but overall it's a fairly aggressive allocation, pretty much 100% equities. And some of those funds do pay dividends. Most of them do. And your viewpoint is like, why the hell do you need that? And you're right. I don't necessarily, quote unquote, need it. And that's fine. And I could agree with you, and I could completely invest in something or different ETFs that say don't pay dividends or even lower dividends because I have the real estate. But let's take it from the standpoint of the person that maybe they don't invest outside of the stock market and that's their only investment, or they want to build some sort of passive income, but maybe they're not well capitalized enough to get into real estate investing just yet, let's say. And you don't really need to have that much money to get into real estate, but we can talk about that if you want. I think for them, having the dividend there is more of a peace of mind thing. For somebody like me that's investing in multiple areas, so I mean, you know, not to do a spoiler alert, but I believe in having a combination of both, primarily cash flow investing, but also growth-oriented investing. And for somebody that has both, it still gives me the warm and fuzzies, but I could do without it. But for the average person that doesn't do sort of cash flow investing through other non-stock market means, I would say that it gives them the warm and fuzzies even more so, if that makes sense. And maybe they don't need it, but it's still, it is a good feeling. And at the minimal tax drag expense, I would say most people would argue they can make their own decisions, but I would say that it's worth it. Even for me, who doesn't need it, I still like having it, and I don't have a problem paying a little bit of taxes because, you know, that's fine. I'm essentially, I don't know if we want to go down this road, but I'm essentially legally paying very little, if any, taxes on my real estate investments for the way the tax code works and many different reasons. I don't really care if I have to pay a little bit on stocks, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I understand what you're saying and doing both, but especially in your case, it's like, why even waste your time with the stock market trying to use the market as a cash flow mechanism whenever you don't need the cash flow? And from your real estate investments, you're going to get better cash flow than the market can give you anyway. So why not invest in the stock market in aggressive growth, whereas you have your cash flow covered by your real estate holdings?
Yeah, I mean, I could do that, and I see what you're saying, and maybe I'm an idiot for not doing that, but I don't know. I think it's a mental and psychological thing, and that's the biggest part, I guess, of personal finance in general, is that, you know, it is personal, and there's the numbers, and then there's like the emotional component. I think we talked a little bit about that on one of the episodes with regards to emergency funds and how there's like the financial part of it, and then there's the emotional overlay, I think is how I described it. And I would say you can draw a lot of parallels between that and different types of investing in general. But yeah, I invest the vast majority of my after-tax dollars, especially now and have been for the past almost 5 years, into real estate investments. And so for me, you know, and again, you can make an argument here, well, that's really stupid. But like, as a cash surplus, there's a few different vehicles that I use, one of which is a taxable brokerage account where I don't want any crazy fluctuations. And you're going to say, well, why the fuck are you 100% equities? Well, I am 100% equities, but there's some value-oriented investments that are in there. And there's some shit that's more volatile. And I understand that. And I understand the risks of that. But ultimately, eventually, a portion of that money will either be used to put directly into real estate in the form of liquidation, which I don't like, or, to your point earlier, a margin loan, where now the particular firm, I don't want to plug anybody here, but there's a firm that we both use where you can, it used to be 35% on most securities, now it's up to 40% in terms of leverage on your equity-based portfolio with them, where you can take a margin loan against the value. And as long as you do that within reason, I think it's fine. And so at the end of the day, if you look at it on a percentage basis, like what percentage of my overall wealth or net worth does that represent? It's not very much. So I really don't, I mean, I would say I don't give a shit, but like, it really doesn't matter either way.
Right. So why not put it in a more aggressive or growth company as an asymmetrical bet that, you know, it means nothing if you lose it, but you could buy two extra rental properties if it, you know, goes to the moon, as they say.
Well, yeah, okay, I could, but then I could also take that money and lose the one, let's say, rental property or the down payment and closing costs and whatever else I was going to use for the next rental property. I'd rather just buy the one and not worry about the two, because, you know, it's a slow and steady process in my mind. I mean, you know, again, I can't fully disagree with what you're saying. I just can't get myself to do that because, I mean, you know, I just, it's not what I'm wanting to do personally, you know?
All right, then my second hot take would be that I know we talked some about emergency funds, but cash is absolute trash.
All right.
You know, especially right now. I mean, I think they came out, I guess it was last month, and inflation's at 7.9% according to whatever the government released, which probably means it's realistically closer to 12%. So any money that I have sitting in cash, I just assume I'm losing 1% a month every month that it sits there. So in times like this, I do, you know, have the flexibility, mostly because of my savings rate, that, you know, I can keep the amount of cash that I have pretty low, because I know, you know, what I have coming in every month and roughly what I'm spending. So, you know, I think that that's something for people to focus on, or something that I'm focusing on now as far as my philosophy is getting, I guess, getting more comfortable with less cash, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. And we've talked about that several times. We talk about it all the time, really. And, you know, it's funny. I don't know if we've talked about this yet, but I've had a few different events happen recently, and I actually kind of made a list of them here, where, you know, you've always kind of encouraged me to, hey, you know, you really don't need to keep that much cash, and why don't you invest it, and here's how much money you're losing to inflation, and oh, if you only had that money in the market, and there's an opportunity cost, and I get all that. And I would say that, and I know what you're going to say when I say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, depending on how your investments are structured. So just based on the fact that I have rental real estate, and I keep that separate as a business, I run it as a business, but and that does require some capital there, and there's different levels and metrics that different people will use, but I need to have a certain amount of money to make me feel comfortable. And you could say, well, that's a cash drag, and that reduces the overall return of your investment. And my response would be, yes, you're right. However, when you look at both things that can happen from a business standpoint and things that can happen from a personal standpoint, I'm not saying to hoard cash by any means, but I think there needs to be certain minimum thresholds, which again are going to be different for everybody, that need to be in place. And I'm going to go through this list here real quick, and this is real life, of things that are going on right now that are happening that I'm going to need cash for and or that cash flows will pay for. And so on the rental side of things, unfortunately, I had a tenant who passed away at a very early age, in his 30s, as a matter of fact. He passed away, and there was a whole host of stuff going on with that. So obviously, if he's not living, he's not paying rent, right? And so when it's all said and done, I'll probably have approximately 3 months of lost rent, plus the turnover costs to get the unit rent ready, plus there's a tree, a big ass fucking oak tree in the front yard that a year and a half ago we had trimmed because the neighbors were complaining that some of the branches were overhanging and falling, you know, in their driveway. The last thing I want is a big insurance claim, which in my particular case, I got a $2,500 deductible on the insurance component anyway. I don't want anything to happen to my property, to their property, to anybody's vehicle. So I made the decision to go ahead and have the tree removed, which is not inexpensive to do. So all that happened, and all that's sort of contained within and will be paid out of the business account. So I'm glad I do have some reserves there to handle that. In addition to that, there's just other things that happen in life. So I unfortunately had to take my dog to the vet recently and found out that he needs to go back in 2 weeks, or probably about a week and a half now, to have surgery. So that's a personal expense that's coming up. I got the thing in the mail for car registration renewal. Well, that's just life, but that's coming in and that's due. In about a month, I'm going to pay my auto insurance for the next 6 months. So that's another expense that's coming up. Here we are at the beginning of April, on April 3rd, recording this. I'm getting ready to pay income taxes. I need to pay my CPA, my income tax advisor. And right before we got on the podcast today, the missus told me that we apparently have a leak under one of our bathroom sinks. So that's something else that will have to be dealt with. In about a month and a half, we are going to be going away on a very nice vacation, and that's going to cost a big chunk of money. And the list can go on and on and on, and that's all in addition to your everyday living expenses. And you can say, well, that's just life, and you plan for that, and you budget for that. And you do. But you're going to have times where life just kicks you in the face. And I think having a certain level of cash, which again, that threshold's different for everybody, is very comforting. At least it is right now for me, knowing that that's going on, even though I'm still planning on making some fairly large investments. I'm probably going to be, I'd say in the next 2 months, under contract on another rental property that's going to cost a chunk of money for down payment and closing costs. And so, you know, there's another syndication, which we haven't talked much about on the show, that is going to be opening up at the end of this month that I'm probably going to put a chunk of money into. So there's, and those are investments. I don't have to do those. Those aren't expenses per se, but I do want to keep up my savings rate. But the point is, there's always going to be a whole host of things that can come up. Again, not to hoard an overwhelming amount of cash, but I do think if I ran my cash position down leaner than I otherwise would want to, I probably wouldn't be sleeping too well right now, because that's a lot of shit. You know, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it is a lot of stuff, but still at the same time, your savings rate is high enough that you can essentially float probably damn near every one of those expenses on a credit card, get you some credit card points.
Love those. Yeah, buddy.
And pay them off, pay it off the next month. You know, you can float it for basically 2 months, and get it paid off if, you know, don't have the cash to cover all of it, you know, right at that second.
So yeah.
I think in general people are just more conservative, I guess, than they should be, and just don't realize the downsides that do exist with keeping a big hoard of cash, you know, in a bank account that's still giving you 0% interest, basically.
Well, here's a little bonus tidbit for the listeners. And I debated doing a special show about this. And I try to keep this show as general as possible when it comes to different types of, especially with investments and, you know, really anything. We do different topics, but I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole. But one thing, and there is some things to be aware of from a liquidity standpoint with this, but I was debating doing a show on inflation and I-bonds, which are issued by the Treasury. And I guess we can spend just a minute here. There are some ways to essentially keep a fairly healthy cash position, but to your point, it doesn't necessarily all have to be in a bank account. So you may have a sliver or layer of money that is fully liquid and accessible that's going to earn a dog shit interest rate that's negligible, if not zero, because it's 100% liquid. And, you know, that's fine. But then you may also have another layer that's kind of more like a quote-unquote CD, if you will. And in this particular case with I-bonds, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the gist of it is right now, if somebody were to purchase an I-bond, and for those that are interested in learning more, you can go to, I believe it's treasurydirect.gov and type in I-bonds and you can read all about them. And maybe we'll do a show on them in the future. I don't know. But for the purposes of today, we're going to keep it short and sweet. And the gist of it is there's a composite interest rate, which is made up of two different components. And the largest one right now, essentially the sole one right now, because the base rate is zero, is based on inflation. And so if somebody were to purchase an I-bond now, they would get the equivalent of an annualized yield of 7.12%, which will reset and it compounds every 6 months. And the liquidity part of it is you can't take any of that money back out within the first year. And if you do take money out within years 1 through 5, there's also a slight penalty on the interest amount. They basically will retract the last 3 months of interest earned. But after 1 year, you can still get at those funds if you need to. So similar in some ways to like a CD ladder, certificate of deposit ladder, you could, and I've actually started to explore this a little bit, experiment with some I-bonds, right? And for most of the time, again, you can read more about it, but most people can do up to $10,000 per year per registration. So typically that's going to be per person, depending on how you take ownership of it. There's some ways to do some additional dollars in the form of a tax refund. We don't have time to get into all that. But the point is you could put a sliver of money aside in addition to just your base cash, knowing that it will be available in 1 year, and then ladder those out in such a way that you're always, say, every 6 months to a year, however you want to do it, you're always going to have a chunk of money that's coming due at that time. Now, should you put a substantial amount of money there? No. And as I said, there's limits and you can't really put, quote unquote, all that much in there. But it might be an idea, as opposed to keeping 100% of your liquidity or your emergency fund in a bank account in cash. There's other ways to do that, right? What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a better option than a bank account. I know that they have become pretty popular as far as, you know, reading financial people on Twitter and stuff like that. But, I mean, to me, realistically, you're just, yeah, it's a better return than the bank's giving you, but you're basically locking in a loss on all of that money because the inflation rate is higher than 7%. So, you know, and I'm not saying that I have an answer to the problem, and I'm not saying that that's a terrible answer. I mean, it's better than a bank account, but at the same time, I mean, you're basically locking in losses to what real inflation is. And I'm sure that most of your listeners, probably all around the world, even the ones in Singapore right now, are realizing when they're going to the store, everything costs a shit ton more. Gas is super expensive right now, and everything's going to keep going up. You know, the question becomes, I guess it's another thing that, to me, it comes down to like I always say, your savings rate, and then I guess what your level of risk you're willing to take. Because, you know, that money that you put in I-bonds, I would just take it and put it in stocks. And, you know, obviously that could go down 50% at any time, but, you know, at the same time, it's not money that I'm really needing per se. I guess if an emergency came up, I could have to liquidate it down 50%. That would be, I guess, the all-time worst case scenario of what could happen. At least I get a tax deduction for it. But you know, I just think that it's, you know, it is an option. It's a decent option. But just my line of thinking is, well, it's still, but yeah, theoretically, it keeps up with inflation, but the numbers that they report and what people really see when they're, you know, going to the grocery store or going to buy a car or something like that, it's a completely different world that the government's living in when they come out with those numbers. I think I heard just today that, what was it? It was like standard goods that a household buys, between groceries and whatever else, you know, standard things like home payment. I think the average increase for a person right now is looking like $6,000 a year extra that they're, in addition to what they spent last year, they'll be spending this year because, you know, inflation is so high right now.
Well, but is in the context of cash flow investing, I think the best quote unquote investment, at least right now, and has been the case and probably will likely continue to be the case, is long-term fixed interest rate debt, especially debt that other people are paying off for you in the form of rental properties. And I know we've talked about this. I don't know that I've mentioned this on the show, but I restructured some things on some rental properties that I have, and I was able to, and I'll fully admit I got lucky. I didn't do anything overly substantial. Like I said, I am super lazy. I don't do any rehabbing myself or anything like that. We might do a show someday on turnkey rentals. That's basically what I buy from the single family rental standpoint. But I restructured the mortgages on those properties into one commercial loan, and I had a weighted average interest rate at the time of 5.01% fixed for 30 years. And I was able to take that down to 3.75% fixed for 30 years. And in the meantime, as part of that cash out refinance, I pulled out 100%, just slightly north of that, of my original investment. And those properties are still cash flowing. Now, I'm not going to retire tomorrow off of them, but again, it's a long game. And I added to my debt, and I was able to take that money, and a chunk of it I've already invested and placed into some other cash flowing investments. And there's a chunk that's still behind that's soon will be placed probably in the next 30 to 60 days into other cash flowing investments. And as I mentioned a little while ago in the show, I'm getting ready to go under contract on another rental in the next couple months. And honestly, the prices are, you know, to your point with everything these days, they're through the roof. And yes, the numbers still have to work. And yes, the property still has to cash flow and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, I think the real quote unquote deal right now from an investment standpoint is the debt. I want to lock up as much long-term 30-year fixed interest rate debt as possible and have other people pay it off for me. And that's only one of several different components and ways that real estate investing can, you know, depending on the type of real estate investing that you're doing, pays you, right? That you can make money from, that you can earn a return from. And I think that's the real deal right now. And so I guess one way to basically flip inflation on its head, and this is true even if you don't own investment real estate, even in the context of your own mortgage. We had a show, The Power of Your Mortgage. Check that out if you want to, if you haven't already listened to it. And when, you know, you think about long-term fixed interest rates, like, you are essentially profiting by having that. I'm holding that commercial loan at less than half of reported inflation. And according to some of the comments that you've made, probably even less than that. So the value of that debt is being eroded away every single second of every single day. And that actually is a form of a return because, you know, it just becomes easier and easier to pay it off. Think about, like, you know, back in the day when you could go to the corner store and buy a fucking, like, gummy bear for, you know, 5 cents, 10 cents, whatever it is. How easy would it be for you today to go to the corner store and buy a gummy bear for 5 or 10 cents? You would laugh. It's a joke, right? Or back when you used to be able to buy a bottle of soda for whatever it was, a dollar or less than a dollar. If you go to a convenience store today, unless you're getting some kind of promotional deal, more than likely it's going to cost you, I don't even know how much it is because I don't buy a lot of soda, but probably $1.50, $2, $2.25, something like that. So think about if you still only had to pay a dollar, how much easier is it because of inflation to buy the same thing? And it's the same concept when it comes to the debt. So I would say that's a huge component of cash flow investing. And not all cash flow investments will have a debt component necessarily. They all will work a little bit differently, but that's a huge thing, quite frankly, that you're not going to get when it comes to, or you're not going to get directly. You can make a, you know, a comment or argument that you might benefit indirectly based on company decisions for financing purposes, but you're not going to get a direct benefit like you will with direct ownership of certain types of real estate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the debt, and I guess, well, the only real estate that I own is our house, and we are at 2.75% 30-year fixed. So I have no plans on ever making an early payment. I will probably never be able to refinance it again to get a lower interest rate than what I have right now, because I believe here recently it was like the biggest gain in 30-year mortgage rates in, I think it was 11 years that I saw. So I think right now, like, the average 30-year fix is all the way up over 4.5 now for primary residence.
Yeah, it sucks.
So it's, yeah. Investment
properties are even more than that. I mean, you know, yeah. There's numbers change every day, but I think last I had checked at the recent pre-approval time was, depending on points and loan amounts and if it's a single family versus a small multi or whatever, I mean, it was anywhere from about 5.5% to 6%, give or take a little bit, because investment property mortgages are generally almost always going to be higher interest rates than a primary residence, right? For obvious risk factors from the bank standpoint. But even still, and as much as that quote unquote sucks, and I'm not going to like it when I'm like, man, you know, I got pretty much all my debt at 3.75% or less. Like, now I have to sign this thing for whatever it's going to be, 5.5%, let's just say. And that's, you know, doesn't feel good. But at the same time, over a long period of time, I still think that it's the right decision. Again, assuming all the other numbers on the particular deal work. So that's a huge part in my mind of cash flow investing. And then I guess the last thing I'll say on it, and I know the show isn't specifically on this, but we've talked a fair amount about it today with the rental property part of it, is it's an inflation adjusted income stream. So we've all probably heard or seen articles that rents have gone up over time. The house that I just mentioned where the tenant passed away, he was getting ready, and that house hasn't had a lot of rental increases since I've owned it for about 4 years or so, really not much at all to speak of, but his rental rate was getting ready to go up by $120 a month. And now that we're turning it over and it's not an existing tenant where we're doing a renewal increase, which are typically smaller, and we're able to just put it on the open market, which, by the way, it was listed for not even a day and a half when we re-rented it. And you're going to say, well, you could have charged more, but it ended up being a $345 a month increase on the amount that we're able to get. And it's a great house. So the point is that those rental amounts and essentially that income stream that's generated from that and any other rental property is inflation adjusted. Another reason why I like investing in certain types of real estate, because in my mind, I'm essentially creating my own pension that one day will be significant. And for the time being, the goal is to build that to the point where it completely covers your everyday living expenses. And I've made pretty significant progress on that over the past 5 years. But that's another powerful benefit of cash flow investing, right? And what are you going to tell me? Well, cash is trash. And even if the inflation rate goes up, like, what are you going to do with it? Right? I mean, what are your thoughts there?
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, it's all good and well that you're getting more cash. And obviously that part will keep up with inflation. But what are you doing with that cash flow after you get it? Are you sending it in a bank account? Are you trying to deploy it into another investment as quick as possible? Or do you let it just sit there in case an emergency happens and you know, essentially have it
all the above,
creating a cash drag?
Yeah, all the above. You're right. I do have a little bit of a cash drag. I do have certain metrics for reserves, right? So I do put aside a certain amount for reserves. But every time I have rent that gets deposited from the property management companies into my account, there is a percentage that also goes into an account. And it is a bank account. And yes, it's going to get whittled away by inflation, you know, whatever. But it's titled Next Rental. And that money will be used in conjunction with some other funds if needed for an upcoming purchase. And so it's, you know, I always joke and say I like to make my houses have babies, rentals by rentals. And, you know, if it's enough to fund 100% of the down payment and closing costs, great. Will it this time? Probably not. I haven't really been doing that for 5 years. As a matter of fact, I think I started doing that maybe not even a year ago, but it will definitely, I mean, it's a nice little chunk that's sitting there that will be used to purchase that next rental. And, you know, the goal is essentially to just create this machine that pretty much just multiplies itself. And it's a slow start for sure, but it's definitely something that can be done over a period of time. But yeah, in the meantime, I do have to have more cash than I otherwise would in the real estate business just to be able to feel good and be able to sleep at night. And I am experiencing cash drag, and you can say inflation's rotting the money away, and you're 100% correct. But I understand that. And when I look at the total return from rental real estate in general, and I guess for the listener's sake, I'll just break it down real quick. I wasn't going to turn the show into a rental real estate show, but I'm sure I might have piqued some interest with a few people here. So we'll just run through it real quick. And I didn't come up with this, but there was a gentleman at one point, and it kind of stuck with me. Everybody has their own acronyms, but he described real estate as the ideal investment. And if you just take every letter of the word ideal,
right? The I is going to stand for income. Income is in the form of cash flow. So even after all your debt service, if you have any, if you have a mortgage, which I do, any of your reserve amounts and any of your other operating expenses, hopefully you're going to have a residual component as cash flow, as income. So that's the first way that you make money with rental real estate. The second way, the D in the word ideal, is for depreciation. So if we look at a depreciation deduction, essentially, and there's going to be different ways to do this, and it's probably beyond the scope of today's show, but just really simply on a single family home, and if you're not doing a cost segregation study, which most single family homeowners do not do, you can look that up if you're interested in it. But essentially, the IRS looks at it and says, all right, look, you got this rental house. Part of the value of that's going to be the land, and that's never going away. So fuck you. You can't depreciate that. But you can take the value of the property and depreciate that generally over 27 and a half years for a residential property. So you take the value of the home itself, divide by 27 and a half, and that is a quote unquote paper loss, essentially deduction that you're getting to take each and every year. So then you could look at it and say, okay, well, what's my effective tax rate? And multiply that by that dollar amount of that depreciation deduction, and that is a form of return that you would get. Then you have the E in the word ideal for equity growth. So, you know, some people will refer to that as principal pay down. Every month that your tenant pays rent and you're using that rent to pay the mortgage, and that mortgage amortizes over time, you have a principal component, right? The debt reduction itself. And then you have an interest component. And that, you know, generally speaking, the interest is front loaded and you're going to pay more, you know, the same, the principal interest payment is going to be the same, but more of that goes towards interest in the beginning and more of that will go towards principal at the end. But even in the beginning, in year one, when you buy the property, a portion of that rental payment, that P&I, will go towards the principal. So that's another form of a return. Then you have A in the word ideal for appreciation. I, when I run my numbers, assume 0%, and I happen to buy in certain markets that are considered quote-unquote cash flow markets where they're not known for appreciation, and so I assume that my homes will never appreciate, and I was shocked and, again, got lucky with the real estate market that we've had. They appreciated so much that I was able to pull all my down payment and closing cost money out for further investments, still maintain the assets, not have to liquidate them, not have to sell, and they still cash flow. But the appreciation, especially if you're leveraged, if you take a loan out for 80%, right, and you put down 20%, what's that, 5-to-1 leverage? So if the appreciation in a given year, let's just say for round numbers, it went up 5%, okay, and that's not going to happen every year, but let's just say it does, it goes up 5%, and you're leveraged 5-to-1, that's a 25% return, and that's only on that one component. Again, I assume zero, but that is, you know, real estate prices generally do go up and keep pace with inflation over time, so that's the A in ideal. And then the last one, the letter L in the word ideal is for the leverage component that we've kind of already described when it comes to if you're leveraging the property and sort of the inflation profiting benefits that you're receiving. If you're borrowing at 3%, 4%, 5%, and inflation is at 7, 8, 9%, you're winning right there. So that's another tailwind that you get. And when you add all those things together, depending on how you run your numbers and the assumptions that you use, it's a pretty nice return. Generally speaking, it's going to be better than an average annual return in the stock market unless you have cube crusher picks and you're just knocking it out of the park and going to the moon all the time. You know, that's kind of what we're looking at. So when I look at that, the point is when I look at that total return and then I look at the cash drag on the little bit of a surplus amount of cash I need to keep to make sure that the business runs itself and is well capitalized, I think it's a small price to pay in the overall scheme of things. And that's the way that I view it from a cash flow investing standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think that rentals are, you know, a good form of cash flow investing. The last letter there to me, and you could probably do a whole episode about it, the leverage. Leverage is how you get rich. If you can probably find a person that's rich without using leverage of any kind, but they probably really had to work their ass off to do it. I think that leverage is probably the most important part to, you know, super speed your returns or increase any returns of investments that you have, is that leverage part of the equation. And like you said before, you know, if you can get long-term debt at a very low rate, it's going to be very advantageous to grow your wealth or compound it more quickly than you otherwise would. You know, there's one thing that I do in investing that we won't get into, but trading some futures, and that involves a huge amount of leverage, but it can also create really big returns, but in that case it can create really big losses as well. But you know, for finding different ways to creatively use debt and strategically use debt, if you look, you know, at any of the filthy rich people, that's, they either, you know, founded a company or they used debt somehow to create a super amount of wealth.
But even look at some of, like, and that's the biggest paradigm shift I think that I've had over the past 5 years. Like, I was always, and I think I've talked about this on other episodes, but like, I was always of the mindset where it was, you know, you got to be debt-free, pay everything off, pay off your home early, all that shit. I think I talked a little bit about that on the Power of Your Mortgage show. And I believe that that was the right way to do things. And it's just so crazy to think about, like, you know, the whole Robert Kiyosaki thing, right? Where it's like, you know, people are told to go to school, get an education, get a good job, make as much money as possible, go to work, get that money. Now you're going to save that money and you're going to pay taxes and all this other stuff. And it's like, if you look at where inflation is, and we all do this, I mean, I still have a job, right? We go to work and we have earned income. We work for a paycheck, and then we get that paycheck after whatever, you know, deductions and benefits and taxes and whatever. And by the way, earned income is generally taxed the least favorably of everything else, which is why the whole name of the game is to take your earned income from work or a business, your wages, whatever, and shift that into investments that can generally produce returns and income on a much more tax favored basis. And so, you know, going back to Robert Kiyosaki's whole cash flow quadrant, that's like the name of the game. But there's so many people that do all this. They work so hard, they work 40, 50, 60, 80 hours a week, and then they save their money. They don't invest their money. And then inflation just ripped its fucking face off. And then they wonder why, like, how am I not getting ahead? Right. And that's a very real thing for a lot of people. I'm not saying go out and, you know, take on as much debt as possible that you personally have to pay for, that you have no way to support that. That would just be catastrophic and just stupid. But if you can, you know, I've not been able to find another vehicle other than some type of real estate investing where I can use leverage to the point where I'm comfortable with it. And in order for me personally to be comfortable with it, I need to have a little bit more cash than maybe I otherwise would need to have, or maybe even a little bit more cash than other people would feel like they need. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, like, that is, to your point, that's the way to get rich. And what I was going to say is, if you even look at some of your favorite companies or any company really, and you look at their balance sheet, like, I think Apple, people have talked about Apple, and again, not a recommendation. We do not give advice on the show. I don't know how many times I have to say that, but I'm going to keep saying it. That you do your own due diligence on whatever you want. But somebody at one point had talked about, like, if you look at Apple's balance sheet, yes, they have a shit ton of cash, but they also, and a lot of companies also, have debt. And it all comes back to the cost of capital and financial arbitrage, and can you borrow at a lower rate and make better use of the money at a higher rate? And that's essentially what we're doing with, whether it's real estate investing or any other type of investing, the magic is all in the arbitrage. But you need to be careful, because leverage cuts both ways, and you can also get yourself in a whole heap of trouble if you're not responsible with it. And so when I look at, like, you know, I'm not trying to make this show about me, but I can only talk from personal experience here. You know, if I look at my experience and situation with real estate investing, in order for me to feel comfortable with the amount of leverage that I have to have a certain amount of cash. And if I look back, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 years ago, when I first started investing in real estate and I looked at rentals, like, could I have saved a little bit more and maybe bought that particular house in cash? Yeah. Would it have taken me a little bit longer to get involved in real estate in order to do that? Yeah, probably would have delayed it by a couple years. Well, now prices are going up over that time. But let's say I did buy it in cash. Now I have one income stream. I have no leverage. I lose a lot of the benefits that we just described, and I'm not able to do everything that I was able to do. Whereas what I obviously didn't do that. What I did do was leverage, in my opinion, responsibly, put 20% down on the single families, got a loan for 80%, still had a solid financial foundation, still had cash reserves, let real estate work its magic over time. Again, yes, I got lucky. Home values appreciated, but now I have multiple income streams instead of just one. Yes, I have debt on all of them, but collectively, the multiple income streams, when you total them up, are more than I would have had with one paid off home and only having one income stream. And when you look at a situation like, you know, earlier I mentioned the tenant passes away and lost rent and turnover costs and everything else, if I only had that one home that I paid cash for, I would not have any other income streams to support that and would rely strictly on a reserve account, which again is fine, But I think having more income streams is quote unquote safer than having fewer. And as long as you're not over leveraged, and that, you know, it's very subjective, I guess you can define it very subjectively, then you're probably going to be fine and able to weather a much bigger storm. If my, like, you know, there's been times here recently where my 401k has dropped six figures. Most people freak out. I don't give a shit. I mean, I care, but that's a long-term play, right? At the same time, when this shit hit the fan with the real estate stuff, that sucks, but that's okay. It's not my only investment. And so I think going back to the whole idea of the cash flow investing versus growth investing, when you have a combination of the two, however you define those, I think that's really where the magic happens, because no matter what is going on in one area of your portfolio, you have the others to support it. And generally, not always the case, but generally, not everything is going to go up or down in tandem. So you're going to be able to have that balance. What do you think about all that?
Right. So you need to have some non-correlated assets, is what I refer to them as. Things that may move differently depending on how the market's going. I mean, obviously, owning mostly growth stocks, they tend to move together, but there are some that are a little bit more aggressive than other ones. But then also, that's where kind of the crypto came into play for me, was, you know, having something that is not necessarily going to be, you know, one for one correlated with the individual stocks that I hold. Do they move together at times? Well, absolutely, yes. I'm investing in growth companies. Just Bitcoin, for instance, is something that's, you know, growth people are buying and selling, and it tends to move somewhat with the market. But at the same time, I think that is a, you know, an entirely different asset that will perform substantially different over a period of, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. You know, and kind of diversifying, I guess, that way, as opposed to, you know, me having real estate over here, syndications over here, and just muddying up the waters a little bit. It's more of, you know, okay, I'm going to have, you know, these stocks here, this crypto here. And then, like I briefly mentioned, my futures trading that I do that do not try at home. It's more of a master's level of a type of investment philosophy. I would suggest highly doing a lot of research before you started doing it, and realize that more than likely you're going to blow yourself up at some point. But that's kind of how you learn too. And I think that people just have to go out there, get invested, and see how it makes them feel when they open, you know, a statement up and they've lost. You know, I mean, if you don't have much money when you're first starting, you know, it could be, you could lose, you know, $200, and, you know, see how that makes you feel. And then you check the next day and you're down another $500. But then obviously once you, you know, start building over a decade plus, like we have, it's like, you know, you're logging in there and you're seeing, you know, four or five figures, you know, your account can go down.
Or six. Yeah. I mean, it's fucking crazy. Yeah. I mean, you know,
just, you know, and I think that makes people react a whole lot differently, or it'll make you realize how you're going to react, because, you know, I've stared some pretty big losses in the face before in a matter of days, with the type of futures trading that I do. But it's like, it's all about managing yourself more than it is the money.
That's the biggest part of it. Yeah. And just a quick comment on your shitcoin. Again, I don't invest in it because I don't understand it. But I think one important distinction that very easily could be overlooked or overheard, if that's even a word, I don't know. But you mentioned non-correlated assets, and you mentioned Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is part of that. And for you, maybe that works fine. But you are doing that for the purposes of having something that's non-correlated. You are making, as you said earlier, an asymmetrical bet. And you're doing that presumably with a very small portion on a percentage basis of your overall net worth. You're not fucking YOLOing everything you have into that and then trying to shoot for the moon. And I think that's where most people go wrong, especially with volatile assets, where they put 100% of whatever they have, and in some cases more than that, because they're borrowing money that they really don't have or probably shouldn't be borrowing to put the fucking farm on red or black or whatever. And that's not what you're doing. I think that's a very important distinction, especially for the listeners, that there is no get rich quick. And if there is, you can also lose it all pretty quick, more than likely as well. I think the name of the game is to be in it for the long term. And you might need to be a little aggressive, and you're definitely going to need to take action of some kind with whatever investments you choose to make for yourself. But I just wanted to point that out. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you on a percentage basis are not betting the farm in crypto or Bitcoin or whatever the fuck you're buying, right?
Yes, that is correct. I mean, right now it's, I don't know what percentage of my assets it is. It's not very large at all. I have been, I guess, actively working to make it a larger part. You know, I'm with you. I don't fully understand it. And maybe some people would tell them, ask me why the hell I'm investing in these things that I don't fully understand. And I think that a big part of it is just, you know, the investment part or having some skin in the game will help you learn how it works.
That's true. I agree with that 100%.
And things like that. So it's, you know, I didn't jump in with both feet and get balls deep in it real quick.
These nuts. Got him.
But, you know, I am trying to build it over time because, you know, I've been invested in it, I don't even know how long now, for maybe 2 or 3 years. And kind of seeing how it works and trying to do the research. Will I ever 100% understand it? Probably not. But I guess the simple thing for me to understand, or that I do understand, is there is a set number of Bitcoin that will never be any more that are created than the maximum number, which is 21 million. And therefore, to me, that makes it a scarce asset. And typically, a scarce asset is going to go up in value. That's my take. Could it go to zero? Absolutely. 100%. Yes, it could. And I could lose every dime that I've put in it, but you know, it doesn't faze me. Like I know it could happen. I don't think it's likely to happen, but you know, it definitely could.
And maybe I'm wrong here, but no matter what, even if my house goes to zero and the insurance doesn't cover it from property insurance for hazard insurance, I still have the dirt, right? It's never gonna truly be worth zero, or at least, you know, at least that's the way that that I like to think about it. But yeah, I mean, anything's possible. But that's one of the reasons that I'm a big fan of real estate. I mean, I'm sitting recording this at my house, you're sitting recording this at your house. Both of us are interacting with, even if we're just fucking sitting here, real estate. Whoever's listening to this, if you're at the gym, you are in a building, which is real estate. You're interacting with real estate. And for the jackasses that say, hey, asshole, I'm listening to my car, it's not really real estate, it's an automobile. You probably came from somewhere or are going to somewhere where you will be or have been interacting with real estate in some capacity. So that's what I sort of understand. And for whatever reason, maybe I'm just crazy, but I get more excited when I can log into my property management portal and I see the tenants have paid rent and I see the cash flow coming in, even if on a larger scale, on like a dollar basis, it's not nearly as much as any potential growth I might receive on my stock market based investments. I still get more excited about that because it's money that comes in the door today that if I ever lost a job and didn't want to use an emergency fund or just wanted to quote unquote retire early, that is usable net worth. It is usable cash flow. Yes, you can say that real estate is not very liquid. I would agree with that, but I think far too many people overvalue liquidity. And at the end of the day, no matter what you're investing in, whether it's real estate, which should be a long-term investment most of the time, or stock market-based investments, which also should be a long-term investment the majority of the time, if you're going to be investing over that time horizon, which we did a whole show on Time Horizon Revisited, but whatever your time horizon is that you're going to be investing through that period of time, if liquidity is that important to you, chances are that money shouldn't be invested anyway. And so at the end of the day, I think people way overvalue liquidity. Not that it's not important. Yes, you should have some liquidity and keep some cash and whatever. But when people say to me, well, you know, if you put too much money in real estate and something happens and you need to sell them, the plan is to never sell them, right? And anything can happen. But at the end of the day, I'm buying an income stream. I'm creating a pension. I am in it for cash flow. And again, there's a lot of tax advantages for certain types of investments, real estate specifically, that may not necessarily apply to other types of investments, which is why I'm such a big fan of focusing on cash flow oriented investments. But I still do have my growth stuff. I just don't want to rely strictly on that in my own personal investment world and philosophy. So All right, Cube Crusher, we've gone longer than expected here. Anything else you want to close with before we wrap up? Any final words of wisdom or thoughts on anything today?
Yeah, just real quick. I'm going to get you to buy some Bitcoin.
I doubt it. So, I doubt it. We'll take some bets on that. Send your bets in, realtalkpersonalfinance@gmail.com. Get it going, baby.
Whenever you just mentioned, you were talking about, you know, how people are interacting with real estate, they're in a house or they're going somewhere. Part of the value of physical real estate is the scarcity of it. We're severely underhoused, at least in the U.S., and I'd say the same around the world. Not that I'm an expert on the housing market, but that's part of what, you know, gives value to homes is because, you know, we can't create any more land, or at least science hasn't come up with a way to develop more masses of land. So once all of our land is used, there's going to be nowhere else to build.
So you want me to sell you a house? You can give me some Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Bitcoin is the same way. It's, you know, the same. There, as it continues to become more mainstream, there's going to be more dollars chasing the same number of Bitcoin.
But where's the cash flow? Where is the cash flow in Bitcoin?
Why do you need cash? Like, I don't understand why you need cash.
Why don't you need cash flow? I mean, who doesn't need fucking cash flow?
Money, baby. You need net worth. You need passive income. You need flows, baby. Flows and flows and flows.
Because I have a fucking job. I get paid.
Yeah, what happens if you don't want a job? What if you want to stay home and play video games or go take a shit or whatever you want to do? Like, why do you, like, who doesn't need cash flow?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't need cash flow right now.
Then stop going to work. Okay, it's Sunday. Do not go to work tomorrow. And you're going to say, well, I have to. And I'm going to say, why? And your answer is going to be, because I need fucking cash flow. That's why.
No. Well, I'm fine with working right now. But when Bitcoin's going to the moon and you don't own any, and then I want to quit work, I can just sell my damn Bitcoin and just buy another mansion. And
then what? So all right. So you sell. You're going to pay probably huge capital gains tax unless you do some very advanced planning with trusts and incur all those expenses that you always bitch about. Things get too complicated.
Take a loan against your Bitcoin too.
Okay, fine. And so then what? So now you're borrowing against your Bitcoin and you still need what? Cash flow. No matter where you get it, it could be a loan, it could be from the sale, it could be from the proceeds, but whatever. If you sell it, you're liquidating the asset that you very much admire. And if you take a loan against it, I guess that's fine. But when it comes time to talk about things like margin call against that, if the value plummeted for whatever reason, and you got to come up with cash to be able to do that, right? Well, and then you're going to sell more investments that are growth oriented, and you're probably going to pay more taxes depending on your tax rate and situation. Maybe not in your case because you're pretty good at planning. But you know, you're just cannibalizing the assets basically. And my whole point with the real estate thing is, like, I don't have to sell off a fucking bedroom in the house in order to receive the income. I'm going to rent the fucking thing. I'm going to increase the rent. They're going to pay the mortgage off. Inflation is going to keep doing what it's supposed to do. I'm going to keep getting tax breaks, you know, for providing clean, safe, affordable, functional housing. You know, like, I mean, how do you lose with that? You don't.
I don't know. Ask the people that owned it in 07 and 08.
Well, yeah. Fuck them. that's because they were getting those ninja loans. No income, no job, no assets. And they probably didn't have any reserves. And who knows what else. Just completely over leveraged. But, you know, as much shit as I get for keeping a nice cash cushion and buffer, I am thrilled to death that I have it during times like this, because it makes all these other expenses, both expected and unexpected, way more palatable than they otherwise would be, in my opinion.
So why not put 5% of your cash into Bitcoin?
Maybe you'll convince me someday. Maybe we'll do a show on it. And
your cash isn't cash flowing.
My investments are cash flowing. The cash is just, I mean, it's basically a form of insurance, really, right? I mean, it's additional insurance. And like I said earlier, yes, there's a little bit of a cash drag there. And that's fine, because when you look at the total return on investments, and I will chant this to the fucking death. If you look at a single family rental real estate home versus your average stock, and you did total returns over a long period of time, real estate is going to win hands down, especially with shit dex funds that you like to joke about. You could probably pick one stock that just goes to the moon, and of course it's going to outperform anything and everything else, but that's probably an outlier. But if you take the average stock or your average blue chip type of company or whatever, and you put it next to a single family rental home, the rental, in my opinion, will win 99 times out of 100 on average over long periods of time. And so I'd rather have money there. And if I have to, you know, sacrifice a little bit in the form of cash drag, I'm okay with that. That's how I sleep at night.
No.
That's why I'm not going to be one of those guys in 07 and 08. You know?
Apples to oranges. If you have the same amount of leverage on a stock that you have on your real estate.
But you don't. That's the thing. You don't.
You could.
No, you couldn't. How?
I have 18x leverage every day of the week.
On stocks or on futures contracts?
Futures.
Yeah, that's different. I'm talking about stocks.
Yeah, you can probably at least, yeah, you could easily get, I don't know what the. What
all right,
the
if you find a brokerage that's going to give you 5-to-1 leverage on stocks, we're going to come back on the show. We're going to get an affiliate link. We're going to plug the shit out of them. And then everyone's going to blow themselves up and try to sue us, and we'll send them your way. But the reality is I don't think you're going to be able to do that. I think you can have minimal leverage on, you know, most types of marketable securities. And again, those assets are way more volatile than real estate. As long as there's the real estate has a tenant in place, and even if something happens and there's a transition, you get it filled and, you know, turned over pretty quickly, the cash flow is still going to be there. You don't have to liquidate the asset, and the asset value generally is not going to fluctuate that much. You have money in, you know, stocks or whatever. Again, nothing wrong with that, but the value could plummet essentially overnight or within a very short period of time. And, you know, that's usually not going to bode well for anybody's situation if that's their only holding or their only type of investment. I'm not saying people need to go out and necessarily buy real estate. People can do whatever they want. Again, we don't give advice here. Education and entertainment only. Do what you want to do. But I would say it's certainly something that I think a lot of people should consider in addition to any other types of investments they might have. All right. Are we good?
Yep, I think so.
Okay, well, again, thanks everybody for sticking with us throughout the show. Hopefully you made it this far. This has been episode 13, Cash Flow Investing versus Growth Investing, featuring Cube Crusher. And for those that didn't listen to the previous episode, and we had some people that did, and they seemed a little bit confused about the name Cube Crusher. Currently, he, when he goes to work, is in a cubicle. We want to get out of that relatively soon, sooner rather than later. So the idea is to crush the cubicle, hence the name Cube Crusher. Cubicle Crusher is what we're talking about. Okay, let's see. Last thing, again, if you have not already done so and you feel like we've earned it, please consider leaving a 5-star review for the show. We'd greatly appreciate it. If you have any questions that you want to submit, personal finance questions, or you have any show ideas or anything that we've mentioned on any of the shows that you'd like to learn more about, we're certainly open to that. Feel free to send an email to realtalkpersonalfinance@gmail.com. Again, that's realtalkpersonalfinance@gmail.com. And we'll see if we can tease something up for one of the upcoming shows. This has probably been our longest show so far, so we will go ahead and cut it here. Thanks again for listening. We will see you in the next episode.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.